Welcome, everyone, to the City of Melbourne for this very special meeting today of the Future Melbourne Committee, Tuesday 5 May 2020. We're declaring the meeting open at 5:30. We welcome councillors, management, members of the public meeting virtually this evening. Thank you very much for being involved, and we're absolutely delighted that councillors Watts and Riley are legally attending the first virtual FMC of the City of Melbourne following the passing of the legislation last week. It's absolutely fantastic. We've missed you and your involvement in the forums that we have had, but how fantastic that we can now have you formally and legally involved in these proceedings, albeit virtually. It is historical for the City of Melbourne and many other municipalities since the legislation was passed last week. And thanks very much to the team for making all this happen with technology, staples, string, cans and various other things to ensure that we can all participate. And of course, we've got members of the public and presenters participating this evening as well. So welcome to everyone. We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Boonwurrung and the Woiwurrung Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay respects to their elders past and present. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. Today we are proud to say that Melbourne is still a significant gathering place for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. As part of our efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 and pursuant to the provisions of sections 394 and 395 of the COVID-19 Omnibus Open Bracket Emergency Measures, close bracket, Act 2020, council and committee meetings can now be held virtually until further notice. During the period 1 May 2020 to 1 November 2020, councils do not need to provide members of the public to physically attend meetings, providing public access to live streamed events and accommodating participation virtually satisfies the public attendance test during the prescribed period. We value the involvement of presenters, submitters, members of the public, and we're pleased to have been able to find a way to do this during this period. This meeting is being streamed live, and the audio and video recording will be published on the Council's website by close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will also be available on the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Can we please all check our mobile phones wherever we are and have them turned off or to silent for the duration of the meeting? Thank you. The agenda comprises three reports from management. No apologies have been received from councillors this evening. How good. All right, we're advising members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. We're up to item two, councillors, disclosure of conflicts of interest. If any councillor has either a direct or an indirect interest as defined in the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by the committee this evening, please disclose the type and nature of your interest prior to consideration of the item. Confirmation of minutes of the previous meeting. I'm calling on a councillor please to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 74 held on Tuesday 7 April 2020, moved by Councillor Oak, seconded by Councillor Francis Gillie. We're putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Councillors, are you with me? Yes, and so it's unanimous. All 11 councillors are voted in favour and we can declare it carried. Thank you very much. Councillors, are there any matters arising from the previous meeting that you would like to discuss now? Thank you very much. The following submissions have been received in accordance with the Council's Meeting Procedures Code in relation to Agenda Item 6.1, Ministerial Planning, Referral TPM 2019-30, 346 to 350 Macaulay Road, Kensington. A request to speak from Kate Foldy, SJB Architects. And we have received 13 written submissions in relation to this item. In relation to Agenda Item 6.2, Ministerial Planning Referral TPM 2019-5683 to 699 Elizabeth Street, Melbourne, we received an item of correspondence from Jamie Govanlock from Urbis. In relation to Agenda Item 6.4, Proposed Local Law Amendment, we have a request to speak from Professor Colin Mendelson, School of Public Health and Community Medicine, University of New South Wales, and also from Mike Bailey, and noting that we received 43 written submissions in relation to this item. I advise our submitters who have registered to address the committee virtually this evening that you will be invited to do so at the relevant item. You will have 3 minutes to address the committee. It's the intention of the committee to adhere to the 3-minute time limit. Beeps sound at the completion of 2 minutes to let you know you've got 1 minute left, and then at the end of that 1 minute to let you know that your time is over. If you could please finalise your submission at that time, that would be appreciated. Thank you. We move to item 5, public questions, and in accordance with the Council's Meeting Procedures Code, a 15-minute period is provided at the beginning and at the end of each meeting for members of the public to ask questions. To enable the public to continue to participate in future Melbourne committee meetings, we have asked members of the public to submit their questions in writing or register to ask a question via audio link or phone. I advise the committee that as at 10 a.m. today, 3 written questions had been submitted, and I'm going to read those out in a moment. But in reading them out, I'm reading the questions as submitted. I am not attesting in any way to the veracity, the factual nature of those statements, or making any judgment or implication. I am reading them out as received. All 3 questions this evening related to vaping, and what I'm proposing to do is read all 3 questions, and then I'm going to do 1 consolidated answer, as there was some overlap in the questions, and we will manage the response to cover off each of the issues raised. So here are the questions as received. The first question is from Leanne Yermantis. Can you please read out medically scientific proof that vaping is as bad for you as smoking? Or is it that you are helping the federal government recoup taxes paid during the COVID-19 outbreak? There is no scientific medical reports that vaping is bad for you. It has only killed people who buy black market vaping juice and mix it with other chemicals that has caused the death of people in America. Why do you feel the need to ban something that is legal to do in hospitals in Great Britain? Please provide exponential medical evidence to back your misinformed decision to ban vaping. Question 2 is from Philip Kelly. Why does the City of Melbourne at this time, when we have more important matters like coronavirus, I believe that, you know, to consider this matter, you have put on the agenda to ban vaping in areas of the City of Melbourne that is an aid for ex-smokers to quit smoking. Being an ex-smoker, it is hard enough without the City of Melbourne making it even harder. This will affect more people that come in from local suburbs to shop, not to count affecting business that are already struggling with the smoking bans in place now, easy to grab for cash on behalf of the City of Melbourne? And the next question is from Leah Rogers. Hi, my name is Leah. I have a question. I was just wondering if this is really about health or money making. Since doing CARP in capital trials, I have successfully quit only using nicotine made in safe laboratories. Why not make it illegal to use flavours and obviously cannabis oil, but allow nicotine? It's safe if used correctly. 11 out of 11 of us at Harm Reduction have successfully quit. Some weren't even looking to, or allow it through a doctor to help people quit. You can still make money there, hey, and look after Australia Health. My 17-year-old neighbour also quit using a vapour. At least allow it to be an option when all else has failed. Thanks. So they are our three questions received from the public, and we have this response. The item this evening, and we'll hear more of that later during that item 6.4, is about updating local laws, and it's about the substance of which was discussed 7 or 8 months ago. It's not that we're purposefully raising it during this COVID period, but it is a procedural matter that will, if approved this evening, go on to consultation and still have some months to run before it is finalised. We note that it was deferred from March, which was right at the start of COVID when we decided not to consider any other items. So it's appropriate that it comes back weeks later, a couple of months later, with still more of the process to go. But I know that this item will be covered in more detail later. We want to say that the City of Melbourne values the health and well-being of our community, which is one of the reasons why this local law matter, which would align with state government laws and strengthen our smoke-free policy, is being considered. The proposed amendment to the activities local law in relation to e-cigarettes would include the use of e-cigarettes in the definition of smoke and apply to the City of Melbourne municipality. It means that the use of e-cigarettes would be banned in existing and smoke-free areas. Their use outside of these areas is still permitted around the City of Melbourne, subject to Victorian tobacco and e-cigarette regulations, for example, indoors. If endorsed, this proposed change to the local law would go through a public notice, submissions and assessment process before returning to Council for final consideration. So there's plenty of time for particular submissions on this item. The proposed changes are consistent with other Australian states, territories and guidance by leading health and medical associations. The National Health and Medical Research Council and the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, believe that there is insufficient evidence that e-cigarettes have a role as a cessation aid, and the Therapeutic Goods Administration has not assessed e-cigarettes for use as a method to withdraw from smoking, and this means that the quality, safety and efficacy of e-cigarettes is still not known. The Australian Medical Association's President, Dr. Bartone, has said that there is evidence that e-cigarettes normalise smoking, particularly amongst young people, increasing their risk of nicotine addiction and subsequent tobacco smoking, and that the recent vaping-related deaths in the United States reinforce the importance of a precautionary approach where there is potential for doing harm. The proposed changes aim to strengthen our existing smoke-free initiatives by further protecting children and young people from accessing, using and being exposed to e-cigarettes, minimising the potential health risks associated with electronic cigarettes, provide greater clarity for the community with consistency across state and local government legislation, and strengthen the commitment to reducing the harmful effects of smoking, and also go to a main point, which is about the amenity for other people around the city in certain key areas identified for smoking bans within the City of Melbourne. Revenue is not and has never been a consideration for implementing smoking bans in the City of Melbourne. Our emphasis is on educating people about our smoke-free areas, not fining them. There is no money grab from the City of Melbourne's perspective. In 2019, we issued 19 fines for smoking in a smoke-free area across all of the City of Melbourne smoke-free zones. The use and sale of flavoured and or nicotine-containing e-liquids and e-cigarettes is regulated by the Victorian Government, and it's not part of the proposed amendment to the City of Melbourne's Activities Local Law 2019. I thank Russell Webster and Kim Wood for the preparation of the responses, and I feel that that has comprehensively dealt with the items raised in the public questions this evening, and I know there'll be more discussion later. But thank you very much to Leanne, to Philip and Leah for your questions. It reflects also the high number of submissions received and read by all councillors for the item to be considered at 6.4.
Sorry, Lord Mayor, will that extensive response be provided in the minutes?
I think it can be. I'm looking at Keith or, and Marlowe. Sure.
I'm sure. It seemed like a very detailed response that would be useful to be provided.
Good. In any case, though, in the minutes, and they'll be on the video recording as well. So I am now moving to reports from management, number 6 on the agenda, and I'm calling on Councillor Rees to assume the role of chair of the meeting in relation to the planning portfolio. Over to you, Councillor Rees.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. There are indeed two reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio this evening. The first of those is agenda item 6.1, which is a ministerial planning referral, TPM 2019-30 for the property 346 to 350 Macaulay Road, Kensington.
Councillor Rees, I am declaring an indirect interest under section 78C by virtue of receiving a campaign donation, and so I'm excusing myself from the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. All right, would councillors like a presentation in relation to this agenda item? I'm taking that as a
Chair,
no.
I've got a series of questions which I'd like to ask in lieu of a presentation, if that's possible.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. So we may call electronically upon officers. Will that be Alison or Jane? Jane and Evan are online. This is a brave new world we're in here.
Jane. Yes.
Okay. Welcome to Town Hall electronically. Councillor Lippitt, did you want to fire away with your questions?
Thank you, Chair. My first question is, are you ready, Jane?
I am now. Thank you. Yes.
Thanks so much, Jane, and thank you for the report. On Sunday, I asked whether notice of the application complied with Section 52 of the Act, given that it had been overseen by the City of Melbourne and not by the responsible authority. Can you please take the committee through that issue? And I believe there's an update that's come through in the last few minutes from the department, which is pertinent to this issue as well.
Yes, that's correct, Councillor Leppert. So, initially this application was sitting with the City of Melbourne, and it was advertised in accordance with Section 52 of the Act, by sending letters to adjoining nearby properties and placing signs on the site. It then became apparent that the application had a GFA in excess of 25,000 square metres, so the application was transferred to the Minister and administered from there on in by the Department of Planning. They did not re-advertise the application, but certainly when Council advertised the application, the community had an opportunity to submit to NAF. One objection was received, which was passed on to the department. We've been in discussions with the department yesterday and today, and they've advised that they are going to re-advertise that application, notwithstanding that it went through an appropriate process previously, but it will give an opportunity to interested parties to make a submission or objection directly to the Minister for Planning, and doesn't affect the FMC's consideration of the matter this evening.
Thanks, Jane. Just following on from that, and I'm glad you said that, because since the weekend there's been quite a lot of submissions claiming that there was no notice on site. I've checked with you in that time, mm-hmm. and the City of Melbourne's advertisement process certainly required and saw that there was notice on site, but for whatever reason, yeah. it's missed everyone's attention. So this will now mm-hmm. ensure that there will be a further advertising period, and any person wishing to make a submission directly to the Minister will have that opportunity. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you. Does this impact the City of Melbourne's role tonight in any way?
No, it doesn't. Notice was given appropriately to the City of Melbourne by the Minister, and the decision tonight is in response to that giving of notice.
Thank you.
To feedback comments to the department.
Thanks very much, Jane. On the issue of the thanks. Proposed through block links, these mm-hmm. are proposed as part-time public access through block links. My reading of the design and development overlay was that they should be set back in accordance with the laneway provisions. Can you explain mm-hmm. why that is not the case, please?
Yes, it's an interesting, I guess, tension in the TDO in that it doesn't specifically call for laneways or connections through this site in the locations shown, but if they are provided, a strict reading of the table indicates that they should comply with those laneway setback requirements. Both lanes are around 5.5 metres wide. The north-south one is open to the sky and shares the vehicle access at Macaulay Road entrance. The east-west link is partially enclosed for a depth of about 17.5 metres, but at the section furthest to the west from Stubb Street, and it does have a double height arcade, in that enclosed section. The applicant is offering up the through block links as part of their public benefit offer for this site to enable a consideration of going from 6 levels to 8 levels. That's the response on the laneways.
Thank you. The first part of that answer referred to the fact that the laneways aren't identified in the control specific locations. I note that when this control was tested at the panel concluded that new pedestrian connections are important, but their precise location does not need to be specified on maps, and that mm-hmm. the new DDO should be changed to delete the map and specify that development yep. should provide for a fine-grained system of laneways and pedestrian connections that are safe, direct and attractive and publicly accessible, etc. So is the panel's assumption in the way that the control now works, it ended up being wrong, didn't it?
I wouldn't say that it was wrong, but it does seem that there's some contrary provisions within that DDO, in that the laneways themselves aren't mandated, but setbacks are from a laneway.
Thank you. And finally, on the issue of bulk and setbacks, I note that in the report, the delegate, who's done a very, very good job, I don't want anything I say tonight to give any alternative impression, on page 54 discusses the setbacks above the street wall and says that these are justified. There's no discussion in there about the fact that the street wall and setback test has two tests in it. One, the street wall must not exceed a height of 6 stories, and then mm-hmm. the setback should be 1 metre for 1 metre of height for every metre above 20 metres. 6 stories and 20 metres are different in this instance. The heights in the drawings are 20 metres above the bottom of the ground floor, not the actual ground level. Shouldn't that have been discussed, and does this not change the way that the bulk of the upper levels are perceived from the public realm?
Right. In relation to height and setback, so it should be taken from natural ground level, and it does vary across the site. The development's also been designed with a flood level of 3.5 metres to AHD, which has resulted in some habitable areas being raised above the street level by about 1.7 metres.
Sorry, Jane, we can't actually hear you at this point in time. Would you mind starting the answer to this question again and just speak a little slower? We're just having trouble hearing. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sorry, that's fine. So in terms of the street wall, 6 storeys is the mandatory requirement, and this development does meet that. In terms of the actual metre height, yes, the street wall probably ranges due to various different height points across the site from around 21 to 23 metres. And a lot of that is raised because of the Melbourne Water requirement to set the ground floor at 1.7 metres above the natural ground level, because this is in an area that is subject to flooding in the future, potentially. In terms of the upper level setbacks, the level 6 and 7 are sitting at about 4.25 metres. And if you look at the section diagrams within the report, to be fully compliant with the DDO requirements, there would certainly need to be some further adjustments, partially at level 6, but most importantly at level 7, where there would be some loss of habitable space as well. Council officers, I suppose, are satisfied with the bulk as it presents it at the moment. There is a differentiation between the street wall and the upper levels through the setback and the uses a different materiality and colours. And the officers are of the view that that enhances the recessive appearance. But in terms of strict compliance, the street wall is compliant, but those upper level setbacks don't comply with the preferred setbacks of the DDO.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Councillor Leppard. Can I ask of officers, will the minutes record that Officer Jane Birmingham provided answers to questions from councillors this evening? I ask that because in the 170 years that the council has been meeting, Jane Birmingham is the first person to ever make a submission electronically. And I just thought for posterity it was something of note. Let's not forget that the City of Melbourne, of course, predates the colony of Victoria and the Victorian Parliament, so it's quite an institution in this place. All right, we'll get on with it. I'm getting the vibe from the councillors here, and we'll get some advice from officers about that later on. Thank you for those questions, Councillor Leppard. I now call on Kate Foldy from SJB Architects, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. And councillors will be delighted to know that it says allow time for submitter to be unmuted on Zoom before announcing that their 3 minutes has commenced. So, Kate, have you unmuted?
I have unmuted, yes.
Welcome, you've got 3 minutes.
Thank you. Arden Macaulay is earmarked as one of the city's urban renewal areas. Planning controls anticipate transformational land use and built form change. This is clear from relevant planning policies, but also planning controls, which anticipate more height in the neighbourhood. UAG proposes a comprehensive redevelopment of a grossly underutilised site, utilising the framework established by the mixed use zone and DDO 63. Site planning and the facade strategy has evolved from feedback from pre-application meetings with council officers. It has been designed with 5 distinct architectural themes and a series of robust street walls that are anticipated by the DDO 63. The proposal delivers on planning control expectations for excellent architecture, activating ground levels, and minimising the streetscape impacts of vehicular access and public rubbish collection. The project fulfils the scheme's aspiration for a compact, high-density, predominantly mid-rise and walkable neighbourhood with a highly articulated edge that frames the adjacent streets and allows daylight and sunlight to penetrate to the street and to lower building levels. In addition to the very carefully considered architectural response, the project offers other community benefits, including very well-received ESD initiatives, an affordable housing proposition, and importantly, the provision for through-lot pedestrian links, which the structure plan encourages. The pedestrian links have been criticised by objectors for not being designed as per the requirements of DDO 63, consistent with the panel's findings in relation to Amendment C191, we confirm that the north-south and east-west links are not required to be provided, but instead are very positive voluntary contributions to the Council's aspiration for greater permeability through the Kensington area over time. In circumstances like this, where the DDO does not identify the requirement for the provision of links the permit applicant proposes, the Council is encouraged to support the proposed pedestrian links and recognise that their provision provides an excellent basis for Council to achieve permeability, not only on this site, but as leverage to encourage further voluntary link contributions on adjacent sites as they inevitably come forward for development in the years ahead. When mostly not a requirement of the planning scheme, through block permeability is a long-term objective that must start with a single step. The permit applicant has worked hard over the last 6 months to refine and resolve a series of relatively minor but nevertheless important matters to your office's satisfaction. And we believe that the combination of excellent site planning and architecture, excellent ESD performance, fully landscaped pedestrian linkages allowing public access, and a contribution to affordable housing represents a meaningful contribution to the community, which readily justifies the development being approved as recommended. In the balancing exercise required by the planning scheme, there are many more reasons to support this development than not. We look forward to the Council's support for the issue of a notice of decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. That was very well timed. Any questions for Kate based on her submission? No? Okay, in that case, I'm going to move a motion, which I'm hoping to see up on the screen. And I just want to flag to councillors that this is a amended recommendation, which includes some additional conditions that we will come to in the debate. And I'm looking for a councillor to second that. Thank you, Councillor Leppert. As we've heard, this is the former Vision Australia site, which is a well-known site in Macaulay, as on one of the main roads there, Macaulay Road, leading into Kensington. What we have before us, it is a site which is covered by a number of overlays, the most significant of those being that it's a mixed-use zone and it's affected by overlay schedule 26 and DDO 63 and others. And it should be stressed that this is a part of Melbourne which has very much been flagged for development as our city moves to accommodate a growing population. The proposal that we are considering this evening is an eight-storey building with it's actually a collection of six buildings on the site, includes 426 apartments, and it needs to be said has a good mix of two, three and four bedroom apartments. The scheme for the site includes a north-south lane and an east-west link, and we'll come to those in the course of debate this evening. The proposal also includes retail tenancy with six shops along Macaulay Road, and the site includes 500 car spaces and 460 bike spaces. When the proposal was advertised, and I do understand there's been some controversy around that process, there was one objection which was withdrawn. I do note there have been quite a few submissions in recent days to us from the Kensington Association, which have certainly been well read and noted by councillors. And as we heard earlier, the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning have flagged that they are going to conduct a public notice process as well. So there'll be a further opportunity for residents and others to make submissions through that process. Overall, I've got to say, I think this is a development which will add a lot to the Macaulay and Kensington area. And I think there's a number of features that are quite desirable in the project. To begin with, I think Hable have done a very good job in the architecture and design of this project. We could have easily found ourselves tonight considering a site that had two, maybe three buildings on it, traditional, you know, square block form development. Instead, we have a cluster of six buildings using courtyards and through block links. I, for one, would like to see much more of that sort of development in Melbourne. It's very much that European style that you see in cities like Barcelona, Paris, Copenhagen and elsewhere, where you have buildings with courtyards and through block links. And it's a very it's a great way of living, and it's a great way of building medium density living. I also think that the quality of the build is very good as well. I like the use of brick, and I'll come back to that later on. But overall, I think that the development itself is of a high quality and will make a positive contribution to the area. That said, there are a number of conditions which are included in the officer's report, which I commend to councillors tonight, and we've got some further conditions which councillors are going to add also. The first of those is that the mezzanine above eight stories, which covers apartments A1 to H6, the conditions require their removal. I should say there's also a number of conditions that require some changes to the design of some of the apartments to improve the amenity of apartments. That includes things like moving windows. There's one window that looks out into a basement car park. And there's that number of other apartments we are requiring changes to improve the amenity of those apartments and the overall development. One, I think, very appealing feature to this development is the offering up of affordable housing that is in excess of the current requirements in that area. And there are a number of options which the proponents have put forward, each which looks very, very good, and I absolutely congratulate the proponents for putting that forward. Also, just want to flag that there is a requirement for a Section 173 agreement that goes to the north-south link and the east-west link on the site. And I thank the Kensington Association and Councillor Rohan Leppett for his advocacy around this issue as well. And one of the requirements that is in the recommendation this evening is that those links be supported through a 173 agreement that gives rights of public access along the north-south pedestrian link for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and for the east-west pedestrian link, which runs through between the buildings, we are requiring public access from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 7 days a week. We believe that will help fulfil the council's overall desire to see these major blocks in this part of the city contained through block links. And so through that additional requirement, we can deliver on that vision, but more importantly, deliver a better urban setting for this part of the city. And we're very mindful that with this being the first of what is likely to be several major projects that are going to come before us, that we are really trying to set a standard here tonight that we will expect to see other developments in the area follow. Also, I want to flag the urban design report and the requirements for... Well, I flagged earlier that overall the architectural standard here is very, very high, but there is some conditions there that go to a facade strategy. I was absolutely delighted to see the use of brick
in the lower levels of the building. I think that's a very desirable feature. Melbourne is a city that is built of brick. We're very lucky to have good clay quarries close to the city. This city used to have tens, if not hundreds, of brickworks at one point in time, mostly up in Brunswick and Northcote, and they built the city with hawthorn bricks and the red clinker bricks, and they've become part of the fabric of this city and very much a signature of the city as well. So great to see brick being brought back in this development. One thing we have seen in recent times is the use of what I would describe as tile bricks, sort of faux brick facades. And if done right, it can be okay, but often it looks pretty bad. So one of the requirements that we've in the conditions here is that the lower levels will be hand-laid bricks, and I think that's going to add a lot to this development. And we're also requiring more detail around the facade to ensure that we get that materiality, that brick, absolutely right. And I know with Hayball being such a quality architect and a quality developer, and a quality development like this one, we'll get to a satisfactory outcome there. So on that note, I call on Councillor Lippitt to speak to the recommendations and the motion.
Thank you, Chair. I agree. Very briefly on the notice issue, we did only find out a few minutes before the meeting began that the department did propose to hold another round of notice and advertisement just to ensure that the application complied with Section 52. That's really unfortunate. That's not the outcome I was after. I was hoping that we wouldn't see a slowdown there. So full apologies to the applicant. This isn't going to be happy news for them. However, I do note that we were overwhelmed over Monday in particular, yesterday, with local submissions saying this is the first we've seen of the application, we object, and quite a few were reserving their appeal rights. So I think that it's quite important that everything is done to ensure that the application is assessed in accordance with the Act. And so it's unfortunate that there's some added time in there, but ultimately, hopefully, it's all for the right reasons. This is an area of urban renewal, and this is a site that has been marked for intensification, and that is what we've got, and that is what we should be supporting in general. This is a really large and important site in the Macaulay area. It needs to be noted that this is, if not the biggest, amongst the four biggest in that block of the Macaulay sites left to be developed or transferred from industrial or commercial to residential that are west of the creek. And we are setting quite a few precedents here tonight, or the Minister will be when he makes his decisions, about what this area is going to look like. And that's why I think it's only proper that the committee and our delegates, who've done an excellent job, take a really, really close look at some of these precedents that are being set. As the Chair said, there is a lot to love about this application. It is a really beautifully designed application. The materials are wonderful. The facade treatments are wonderful. The architectural capping of the design with the peaked roofs, I think, is actually exquisite. However, when this contributes to bulk, I will get back to that in a minute. I just wanted to acknowledge from the outset that this is actually a really well-designed development. And the affordable housing provision is above and beyond the minimum requirements of the Act. To get above the preferred height limit and to the absolute maximum height limit, you do need to provide benefits above and beyond the other provisions of the scheme, not the Act, I beg your pardon. And the provision of affordable housing meets that requirement in spades, and it is really, really welcome, and I want to commend the applicant. So I agree with Kate. There are many, many more reasons to support this application than there are to not support it. But the bulk issue and the through links are the issues that I've been fretting about over the last few days. And coupled with that, an issue that I'm not allowed to fret about, which is the provision of parking. There are 545 spaces here. Every single apartment here is under 5 minutes walk from two train stations, and under 5 minutes walk to a bus stop, and between 5 and 10 minutes walk to a tram stop. This is one of the best facilitated public transport locations in Victoria, and it doesn't have a parking overlay on it, which means that you could provide 3,000 car parks on site and we'd have to say, fantastic, have a permit. This is way too many car parks. It is far too many than is required for the number of apartments that are provided, and there's nothing we can do about it, but I'm mentioning it now because it is something that council as a future planning authority needs to address. It is also something that I believe has contributed to the bulk of the development when you consider that a lot of the upper basement level is above the actual ground level. The reason the actual ground level is below the bottom of the ground floor is because of flooding reasons. However, the car parks also contribute to the overall bulk once you figure out how to fit everything within the building envelope. So on bulk, the street wall heights strictly comply. 6 storey is mandatory, but I think the 20-metre test hasn't been met because it shouldn't be taken from the height that Melbourne Water has set. It should be taken from the actual ground level, and that's normally where you would take the test from. I concede that there are different interpretations and that I don't have the same that our delegates do, and that's completely fine. The point here is that it's discretionary at the end of the day, but if you just accept without even discussing that extra height that's being built into this factor shouldn't be considered, well, actually, it should, because the overall contribution to visual bulk, once you then add the non-compliance of the setbacks for the levels 6 and 7, or the 7th and 8th floors, it all does add up. What we were going for here was a mandatory 6-storey street wall plus a visually recessive upper floors. We don't have that. We've got more than 6 to the eye plus the balcony balustrade, and then you don't have the upper level setback. And so what you've got here is something that appears as an 8-storey building from Macaulay Road. Now, at the end of the day, there's not a huge difference here, but my point is that the control that we've drafted, the control that we've adopted, is now resulting in development that doesn't look like what the control is trying to achieve. Precedents are being set that the local community feel betrayed by, based on the submissions that are coming through. And absolutely, we need to change this control to provide greater clarity for everyone, because you can drive a truck through some of the loopholes in this DDO 63. The through links as well. I mentioned during the question time what I thought the panel had concluded. I thought the panel deleted the map because you wouldn't want to dictate where the laneways should be, but you'd still get the laneways. We've now even got legal advice on this matter that DDO 63 is drafted is so discretionary that we need to consider the through block links essentially as a gift almost. That's again not my interpretation of the control, and that is alarming. These are massive, massive blocks. It's currently one commercial site and it's being converted into more than 400 dwellings. Of course you need to break up that site with permeability and, if not laneways, properly designed through block links. And my reading of the control is different to other readings of the control, but it says that development should, discretionary, provide for a fine-grained system of laneways and pedestrian connections that are safe and that are publicly accessible. And then it says development along new and existing laneways and pedestrian connections must comply with the laneway controls in Table 3, which suggests to me that there needs to be a setback above the east-west link. I'm told that that's wrong, and this is another example of the very badly drafted DDO 63. Again, we have to fix it. It's driving me up the wall. So I'm suggesting that a way through here is with condition to not try and get 24-hour access through the east-west link, but the most important link is the north-south link, because once it goes all the way through to Robertson Street from Macaulay Road, once the wall testing site is fully designed out, of course that needs to be part of the new local road network. It's almost been designed that way now. I know that this is going to continue to be tested between now and when the Minister makes a decision, and I don't know if we're going to win on this issue. However, I think we need to take a stand and not just fall back on the most conservative possible interpretation of a very badly written control. We need to acknowledge that this site is going to set so many important precedents, and decisions made in this chamber on advice to the Minister are actually going to make a big difference in the livability of Macaulay in future. And that's why I'm putting forward these conditions, and I'm very grateful to you, Chair, for working with me on those as well. very, very last thing, the open space across Stubbs Street, we still don't have any traction with the state. The nursery has been closed for years now. It is still VecTrack land. The number of dwellings and the number of people coming into this apartment far exceeds the population modelling that we anticipated for this site through the Arden Macaulay structure planning process. We need that open space, otherwise this area is going to fail in terms of the public open space metrics that we've put in our structure plan. We need to unlock that site, otherwise the residents of this development will not have the public open space that they need to remain healthy, and we are going to have to reopen that negotiation point with the state, coronavirus or not. If we're going to support development in this city in any context, we also have to support all of the services and facilities and amenities that go along with that. And that open space site, to me, is a no-brainer. But we, of course, need to unlock the political will from the state level and VicTrack in particular.
Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Are there any other councillors who would like to speak for or against the motion? Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Chair. Everything that Councillor Leppard and Councillor Arie said, no. Well, yes, I agree with what both of you have said, and thank you for your detailed work on top of the incredible work that our officers have done. So thank you, Jane and Evan and the team for providing not only an excellent report, but at very detailed conditions as part of your response. But I do agree with my colleagues that we do need to add these additional points, in particular around the bulk and also the accessibility to this, to the through link. So I thank my colleagues for adding those in, but absolutely acknowledge and thank the work of officers. Also to the applicant for responding to our officers, and I can see that through the report, the detailed response and discussion in particular. I mean, I narrowed in around the comments around the additional work around landscaping and thank the applicant for that. I like Councillor Leppert, wish there weren't so many car spaces. I agree, not only are there two trains and a bus, there's the Capital City Trail right on the doorstep, like literally. And yes, there are so many bicycle spaces, so hopefully actually the people moving in are going to be more for the active transport rather than in their cars. But there's also a tram at the other end of the block as well, so very well serviced. I would be remiss not to mention, given I do for every other large development that has come into that section of Macaulay Road, to mention the bike lanes, and this is once again a common more so to us than to the applicant, but that given we want more and more of these residents to be using their bikes that are now going to be able to put onto their bicycle hoops within the development, we need to really focus attention on safe cycling infrastructure, and that that particular intersection that is very busy, it's very dangerous going across the bridge, across Macaulay Road, and access to the Capital City Trail. So we really need to look at, on that left-hand side of the bridge as you're going into the city, actually having a bike access to the Capital City Trail so you don't actually have to cross the road and get onto it, which is what you do at the moment. So usually when I comment on Macaulay Road and bike lanes, it was just a little bit further above and making sure there are separated bike lanes. But here it's about actually better access to the Capital City Trail. So, again, a response to us. But, thank you. The only other thing is I absolutely support the conditions that the officers have put in there around the traffic management plan and real consideration of that when it comes back, because it is an incredibly busy intersection, not only from cars but pedestrians and cyclists. And yeah, given the bulk of this development on that intersection, that really, all of us have to have our eye on safety. And so I think that the additional conditions in there are really important.
Thank you, Councillor Oak. Councillor Pinder.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. I too am supportive of this proposal. Well done to you, Chair, and Councillor Leppert, and of course the officers for arriving at these changes. I would have liked to have seen perhaps the reduced the east-west pedestrian links and the reduced hours down to daylight hours only, because I'm kind of thinking about the safety of children and women. And in winter, 7 p.m. is very, very dark, and 7 a.m. is also very dark. But that's up to the department to review that. The development itself, as we've said, is in an urban renewal area, and close, again, as Councillor Leppard said, to Kensington and Macaulay stations, designed within the planning scheme and structure plan. But above all, it is in a transitional change area, and it will lead the way for other developments of this nature at a time when we need the work, we need the jobs, we need the support of our favoured charities like Vision Australia. So you know, the 10 apartments have been provided for Vision Australia's vision impaired. For the independent living and training facilities is fantastic, with a common lounge and doggy training parks and relaxation parks able to roam on site is equally good. I think it's a very thoughtful and exquisite design response for the 425 new dwellings, plus, of course, the affordable housing. I think I misread that, councillor colleagues, discussion. I thought it was actually 9% affordable housing, but it's not. It's 4 or 1 or 4. I would have liked to have seen 6. Look, UAG were here, some of us will remember, 5 or 6 years ago, and they supported the Leukemia Foundation in a very big way. And today that foundation is thriving, providing space for mums and dads from regional Victoria to stay overnight, a week, 2 weeks, while their kids are being looked after at Royal Children's Hospital. So they do some great work, UAG. Thank you very much for your care and consideration again. But above all, thanks to the officers and Councillor Lippert and Rhys for being able to see this through and enabling us to be able to support it as well.
Thank you, Councillor Pinder. Now, I think one of our councillors at home may wish to submit. Councillor Watts.
Yes, thank you. I'm picking up really on my colleague, Councillor Leppert's comment around the VicTrack land and the opportunity to expand public open space in this area. It seems to me that we've all become very, very conscious of public open space during this time of COVID. And I've actually become aware that we should be regarding it as a right for all of our citizens. So I don't know to what extent through this application process and the commentary that we may be able to provide to the state government to actually push them along to free up some of that valuable VicTrack land, valuable for our community.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Are there any other councillors who'd like to speak for or against the motion? All right, in that case, I will put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, raise your hands. I'm looking at the screen. Councillor Riley, yes, I can see your hand up. Councillor Watts, I'm going to take that as a hand raised, so I declare that carried unanimously. All right, could somebody let the Lord Mayor know that we're moving on to the next agenda item? Which is agenda item 6.2, Ministerial Planning Referral TPM 2019-5 for the property 683 to 699 Elizabeth Street, Melbourne. Would councillors like a presentation in relation to this item? Taking that as a no. So I am just checking we've got the right motion recommendation up on the screen. And wait till the Lord Mayor rejoins us. Welcome back, Lord Mayor. And so I'll move the recommendation up on the screen. And I'm looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppert.
This, and I'll now speak to it briefly, this proposal is for a 85-metre tower at the old, what is known around Melbourne as the Bob Jane site up at the Haymarket roundabout. I could give councillors the history of the Haymarket roundabout, but I don't think I will. I'll save that for later. But it's fair to say that it is a gateway location in our city. It's a gateway site which for a long, long time people have passed through on their way into Melbourne from the goldfields and elsewhere. And so it is only fitting that the City of Melbourne is looking for excellence on a location like this. What we see before us from Urbis and the proponents is Mogrop. Sorry, I was trying to remember the name. Mogrop Management. I'm pleased to say does meet that very high standard. The relevant controls in this part of the city: Capital Cities Zone Schedule 5, and then Design Development Overlay Schedule 6 for City North DDO 61, and others. Those controls do set a 60-metre limit through this part of the city, but as councillors will recall earlier this year, the council approved an 85-metre tower next door to this site, which will be the new global headquarters for CSL. It follows from that that in terms of urban design, you would normally like to see buildings rise up to the corner, particularly when it is a gateway corner like the one we are considering here. And so from an urban design perspective, and with the conditions which we're proposing that will apply to this site, the height before us is a reasonable one and should be supported. I should say also that the city is seeking a 173 agreement to lock in non-accommodation use on this site. That is because the city would like to see this building used for office purposes or for research or in a medical capacity or for an education use, as befitting the knowledge precinct which we have in Parkville. We have seen in this place from time to time, I should go on to say that we also are requiring as one of the conditions a detailed facade strategy, because we want to lock in the design quality, and we do appreciate what I think is quite an elegant design that our Cox Architects have come up with for this site. And of course, we have seen in this place from time to time developers put a project before the city, it gets developed at a particular height, and then at a subsequent point in time we see changes brought before us and people trying to use the precedent of the height to flip the site to a lower quality design. So we're very much emphasising here the need for a facade strategy and locking in Cox Architects and the high quality proposal that we're seeing. We also seek as a condition that the arcade at the ground level should be provide 24-hour access 7 days a week. That's because this is a very large site along Elizabeth Street, and that we do need those three-block links to provide for better linkages through that area, and so we are requiring that 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week access, we think that is appropriate. Councillor Leppett.
Thanks, Chair. I agree. This is a good proposal and it's been assessed really thoroughly, and I thank our officers for working with the departmental officers in coming to these conclusions, and I'm sure the Minister will be looking on this favourably in the very short term. I note what you said, Chair, about the pedestrian links, and I acknowledge Jamie Govanlock's submission. All the submissions have been thoroughly read, I can assure him of that. He's probably listened to the discussion about pedestrian links at the previous debate, and so he won't be surprised that I don't think we should support the curtailing of the 24-hour access provision at this stage, but I fully expect it's going to continue to be prosecuted before the minister makes a final decision. I just make the point that it's probably not possible to make a decision on when the arcade should be publicly accessible based on information about the tenancies that arrive the day before the meeting. That isn't to say that it's not true or anything like that, but if there are genuine issues here that need to be prosecuted, they probably need to be prosecuted in a forum other than the Future Melbourne Committee. So and I'm sure they will be. But at this stage, I think the council should stay firm, stick to, like the previous issue, the spirit and the principles and the design objectives in our controls and design and development overlay 61, and continue to seek these through block links that create a properly permeable built form across this extension of the central city, which is far denser even than the area that we were looking at in the previous debate. But that one issue aside, I fully agree this is a high quality application and it should be supported.
Do any other councillors wish to speak for or against the motion? No, well, look, I'll just reply and add to a comment made by Councillor Leppert around this particular site. You know, if we were here 5 years ago considering a 85-metre tower on what is a site with a 60-metre control, you'd probably say the proponent was dreaming, but here we are actually having seen this entire Elizabeth Street block, formerly owned by Toyota, now being developed for very, very high-end purposes with Trinity College, CSL, and now what we hope will be very high-quality office, medical or research occurring here. And all things considered, the through block link with 24-hour public access is a fairly small concession in the scheme of things. So, on that note, I will put the motion to vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. See, it's all hands up here at Town Hall and at home virtually. I declare that item carried. I now note that the we move to agenda. I now note that agenda item 6.3 has been withdrawn from the agenda. So I now call on the Deputy Lord Mayor Aaron Wood to assume the role of Chair
Thanks,
of the meeting.
Councillor Rees. There's one report from management for consideration under the Finance and Governance Portfolio. That's agenda item 6.4, the proposed local law amendment. And I'd call on Kim Wood, our Chief Legal Officer, who I believe is online. So Kim, please take it off mute and please continue with your presentation. Kim, we got you there.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Go ahead. Okay.
Right. Okay. The purpose of this report is to seek approval to commence the statutory process proposing to amend the council's current local laws to make an amendment to introduce two concepts, one relating to introducing green infrastructure into the local law, and the other is into bringing the reference to e-cigarettes in the local law. When the two local laws were made last year, which seems a very long time ago, there was a commitment made that the local laws would be made in the same form as the previous local laws, and any substantial change will be dealt with by a specific amendment from time to time. So these changes were actually on the agenda last year, and this was proposed to come up to council back in March. It's now coming before you now. And this is a procedural motion, effectively to allow a statutory public notice of submission process to commence. What would happen would be that if this was to pass, the matter would be subject to a public notice. Submitters would have a right to make submissions for at least 28 days. And before a decision could be made on the matter, the Council Submission Section 223 Committee would consider all submissions, hear anyone who wishes to be heard, and make a recommendation to Council. So I'd stress this is a proposal, and until the Council has actually dealt with all the submissions, the decision cannot be made. The main issue, obviously, is the vaping. And I would just point out that the Tobacco Act covers the law in relation to smoking in Victoria substantially. The council's local law has always operated in conjunction with the Tobacco Act. So our local law and the Act talked about smoking, and we had areas where you're not allowed to smoke, which are called smoke-free areas. When the Tobacco Act was amended some years ago to introduce the term e-cigarettes, there's a disconnect between the local law and the Tobacco Act. So what we're proposing here is to effectively reconnect the two. So where there's a smoke-free area in the council at the moment where you can't smoke, for health reasons, for amenity reasons, you would also not be allowed to vape. That's just in the smoke-free areas. It's not for the whole council district. So that covers everything, but I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks very much, Kim. And we obviously had a very extensive response to some of the questions in question time as well that picked up on a number of points that you've just raised. A question from Councillor Oak.
Thanks, Kim. I'm actually wanting to talk about the most important part of this local law, which is the urban greening aspect. And I'll talk to it later to the substantive. But I question, obviously it's been put together, the vaping and the urban greening, as part of this one proposed amendment set. There might be more coming up because of the sunsetting of the local laws, and I understand that there might be more. I guess I've got a question about the procedure. So we've got 28 days, people can make submissions. Is it still possible to separate it out and hear just about, to progress on the urban greening if for some reason there are lots of considerations that might be taken on board because of the vaping law? Just understanding the process that it can still be, we can still progress on the urban greening if there is no contention around that.
Thank you, Councillor. Yes, what would happen would be the submissions committee's role is to consider the submissions received and make a recommendation to council. Now, what the submissions committee recommendation could be, it could be recommend proceed, it could recommend proceed in part, it could recommend not proceed at all. It would be quite possible for the submissions committee to make a recommendation to council to proceed with the miscellaneous amendments and the Greening Melbourne, which don't seem to be have any controversy, and to defer the vaping provisions to another time. That's going to be a question to be decided after all the submissions have been received, and there'll be submissions on in support and in opposition. That will be a recommendation. It will ultimately come to council. But yes, you could certainly disconnect them at a later time and proceed with Greening Melbourne.
I just have another question. In the report that was produced about the urban greening or the green infrastructure local law, there was a recommendation about including an actual definition of what green infrastructure is. But in the obviously the amendment in front of us, it just includes green infrastructure without specifying what that actually means. So. I guess I'm just interested in your view as to whether it's better to just go broad rather than specific in the local law, but to make sure that there's some definition on our website.
There is a definition of green infrastructure in the local law, which defines a number of items. But
yep.
I would say that what it does say is it defines certain things which are green infrastructure, but also allows an ability to prescribe other things which might come along in the future, which would also be prescribed as green infrastructure.
Great. That answers it.
Thanks, Kim. We've got a question from Councillor Pinder.
Thanks, Kim. Just to clarify, if this is about vaping, if this is endorsed tonight, will the bylaw be in place for any future new smoke-free areas? Or will we have to go through this again?
Okay. What would happen would be, if this is endorsed tonight, there'll be a public notice process. Ultimately, it'll come back to council. If council was to decide to pass the local law in dealing with the e-cigarettes, that would mean that for the future, any smoke-free area where you're not allowed to smoke tobacco products, you would also not be allowed to vape. So whether they're current smoke-free areas or future ones, they will be covered.
Thanks, Kim. Any further questions for Kim? And I'm looking at Councillor Watts and Councillor Riley. Councillor Riley's got a question.
Thank you, Kim. Kim, I'm a little bit sitting on the fence on this one. When it comes time to make a decision, how much of the decision-making is going to be based on medical evidence? Because the jury is out and we are getting so many mixed messages, and reading the submissions, it seems to me that there is a lot of confusion on whether vaping is good for your health if you're trying to get off cigarette smoking or it is not. So when it comes to decision time for council, can we have some medical experts talk to us?
Councillor, what will happen is all the submissions which are received during the public notice process will be placed before the councillors. I would expect that the submissions you've received so far are actually prior to the public submission process. They've jumped the gun to a degree. What will happen is every submission you receive, for or against, will be before you. I would be surprised if there's not submissions from Vic Health, from the AMA, from various organisations. But the submissions that we receive, they will all come before the council, and hopefully that will give a pros and cons position.
Thank you.
Councillor Watts, did you have a question? Just, Councillor Watts, you're on mute.
Unmute. No, I'm not. Thank you. So it seems to me that we can, on the one hand, we can consider medical issues, but there's also a question of unacceptable social behaviour, and having been swapped with smoke in various ways and found difficult on our streets, does the law enter into, or is it persuasive to consider social harm as well as medical harm?
When you're considering this matter, you're considering it not just for health reasons, it's for amenity issues, it's for a whole range of issues. The smoking local law, when it was brought in, was not just about smoking. It was about the impact on people using the public areas. So to my mind, I would expect submissions will come in on a range of different aspects. Medical was certainly part of it, but that's just part of it.
Thanks, Kim. A question from Councillor Leppett.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Kim. The submissions to the Future Melbourne Committee tonight, I'm assuming they won't automatically be taken as submissions on the local law during the statutory exhibition process. Can you tell me if that's not the case? And or does management intend to take these submissions and turn them into submissions for the purposes of the statutory process set out in the local law?
The public notice, when it's placed, gives when a person makes a submission, they consent to the submission being used for the purposes of the committee process, the submission process. Usually we would not refer the submissions received to the submissions committee process. That's something we can consider, but usually what will happen is people have an opportunity of at least 28 days to do, they've either refer the submissions or make more fulsome submissions. Sometimes these are quite short and people will actually want to put more detailed submissions in. So generally it would be once the public notice goes in, that's when the clock starts.
Thank you. And finally, can I request then, and obviously if the answer is no, that's fine. Can I request if management is able to undertake to write to all of those who have submitted to us today in order to explain that they have not made a submission on the local law, because I believe some will consider that they have. Is that something that's able to happen?
That
Thank
has
you,
happened
CEO.
Before.
Sorry to put you on the spot. Thanks.
We can ask people to do that. We've done it before where people Brilliant. Have asked, are you willing to refer your submission?
And that, of course, presumes that a decision is about to be made, but thank you.
Thanks, Kim. Any further questions? No? Excellent. So let's move to our first submitter. I call on Professor Colin Mendelson, the School of Public Health and Community Medicine, University of New South Wales. Professor Colin Mendelson, have we got you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Professor Mendelson, you've got 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to make a submission on this very contentious issue. So I'm a tobacco treatment specialist. I'm an associate professor in the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of New South Wales and the director of the Australian Tobacco Harm Reduction Association, which is a health promotion charity. Next slide, thanks. Next slide, please. If we can move it forward. Most smokers want to quit and they try and fail. Oh, we're one slide ahead, too far ahead. Most smokers want to quit and try and fail repeatedly, but vaping nicotine is a legitimate quitting aid which can help many of these smokers. It's used short term to help people quit or as a long term alternative to prevent relapse. We now have good evidence that vaping nicotine is the most effective quitting aid available. It's at least twice as effective as nicotine replacement products. It's also the most popular method globally to quit. It's used by more people than anything else. Next slide, thanks. The scientific consensus is that vaping is far safer than smoking, probably at least 95% safer. It's not risk-free, but there are far fewer toxic chemicals, and those that are present are in much lower doses. Next slide, please. In particular, that's particularly true for passive vaping. So leading health bodies have reviewed the evidence and found there's no material risk to bystanders from exposure. There are chemicals, but they're at levels too low to cause harm. So bystanders are not at risk. Next slide, thanks. And that's because vapor has far fewer chemicals compared to 7,000 in smoke, less than 150 in vapor. Vapor doesn't have side stream emissions, which is the cause of most of the secondhand smoke. Most of the chemicals inhaled by a vapor are absorbed by the vapor, and only about 15% are released into the air. And when they're released, they disperse much more quickly because it's a liquid aerosol. I just wanted to point out too that the lung injury outbreak in the US recently was caused by black market cannabis oils, not nicotine vaping, just so there's no confusion there. A quick word about youth vaping. What we now believe is that vaping is diverting young people from smoking. So youth vaping, youth smoking rates are declining much faster than ever in the US and the UK where vaping is available. Next slide, thanks. And the one after. And the one after that. And I just wanted to point out that as the evidence has become clearer...
Professor Mendelson, unfortunately your time has elapsed.
Oh, okay. Just saying that medical evidence has caught up and the Australian medical colleges now support vaping. And I think there is a place for restrictions for amenity purposes. And I think that's something the council could manage.
Thanks very much for your submission. Any questions for Professor Mendelson?
Sorry, I didn't hear
Councillor
that over the...
Oak?
Sorry, Chair. I didn't hear the comment about amenity. Sorry.
Well, that comment was just to say that I think it's appropriate role for council would be to treat vaping as a potential nuisance. So I think there's a place for signs, requesting courteous behaviour and educating vapers not to blow large clouds.
Sorry, Chair. So the question, is this going to be too complicated for the technology? The question to Kim, because... I'm just testing the technology. May as well. Tonight's a trial night, right? To check in with Kim about his comment, though, that this local law is proposed is about the no smoking areas only, and that this is about amenity, not just about the potential health implications of the passive vaping smoke or whatever you call it.
When the smoke-free areas were introduced, there are a number of reasons for it. It related to, at the time, people eating in the area, people using the area where there was a nuisance effect of the smoke, where it was irritating. It wasn't necessarily health reasons, but it was just because it was impacting on other people who are using the same location, which is why smoke-free areas were introduced. So amenity has always been a key driver behind the smoke-free areas. The other thing I would note is vaping is using e-cigarettes, which are different to tobacco products. So you can use an e-cigarette without tobacco or nicotine in. So this is why there's a difference between tobacco products and the vaping. But it's vaping, I think, is more of an amenity issue from my personal perspective, which is where the tobacco, the when the smoke-free areas were introduced, it was a major focus was amenity.
Thanks, Kim. Any further questions, Councillor Pinder?
Just a quick one, DLM. Is Professor Mendelson still there?
Yes, I am.
Professor Mendelson, I noticed the ATRHA, I hope I've got that right, is a charity. Where's your main funding source coming from?
It's purely from public donations.
Okay.
So when we first were established, we did accept funding from the vaping industry to help set up the charity, but we ceased that about 12 months ago once we were established.
Okay.
It's basically a charity established by medical practitioners to reduce the harm from smoking.
Thank you.
No further question. Councillor Rees.
Thank you very much, Deputy Lord Mayor. Professor Mendelson, we know that smoking causes harm to people, and I think the evidence is also that passive smoking can cause harm to people. You've told us that vaping is 95% less harmful than smoking, so that must mean it is harmful in some way. Do you see that there is any harm caused by passive vaping?
Well, the Royal College of Physicians in the UK and Public Health England have looked at the evidence, and yes, there is some risk and there are some chemicals, but in passive vaping there is an even greater reduction in the chemicals that people are exposed to, because most of the chemicals are absorbed by the vapor at the person who's vaping, and also those particles dissipate much more quickly. The liquid particles that evaporate, whereas smoke hangs around much longer. So for those reasons, there has been after 15 years, no evidence of any harm, any health condition related to passive smoking.
Thanks, Professor Mendelson. And there's no further questions. So I'll now go to our next submitter. Mike Bailey, have we got you there?
Hello?
Mike, we've got you there. Great. And you've got 3 minutes.
Thanks. My name is Mike Bailey. I first started smoking when I was 17. And by the age of 21, I became a daily smoker. Within your smoking career, being a daily smoker is a big milestone, and it's a bad one. You'll have some people that only ever smoke at parties or socially or on weekends. They tend to be people that find it, they say they find it easy to give up. They give up before they're 30 very often. For me, the age of 30, I tried to give up, and I spent the next 10 years quitting and relapsing and doing all I could to try and find out how I could not want to smoke anymore. I read books, I did patches, I did all sorts of things. At the age of 40, I gave vaping with nicotine e-cigarettes a go. And that was the one thing that got me off the cigarettes. It took a while, but I went from a pack a day to a pack a month immediately, and then I got down to none, and I have no interest in having a cigarette now. I'm getting my nicotine from vaporizing a liquid, and it's, for me, it's much safer. I feel much healthier. I don't smell. There's lots of benefits. Vaping is not smoking. And this, what the council's looking at doing is what the Victorian government did in 2016, which is define smoking to include using an e-cigarette. Now, there's no tobacco in an e-cigarette. There's no combustion and there's no smoke. There's the heating of a liquid and creating an aerosol or a vapor. Now, the problem with saying it's the same as smoking is there's political expediency. All laws would then automatically apply to vaping. However, this is used by many, many, many people and recommended by the New Zealand Health Department for people who can't quit or don't want to quit smoking. It's recommended by England for people who can't quit or don't want to quit smoking. Australia is a bit of an outlier. You can't buy nicotine for vaping in Australia, yet you can buy it all through the EU. You can buy it in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, America. And we're a bit of an outlier and we're a bit behind with it. Treating vaping like smoking sends a message to people that it's just as bad. And there's so many media reports that have come out making claims, which there was Tony Bartone, you read out before, that he said vaping-related deaths in the United States. It's since come out that they were not from e-cigarettes. They were not from nicotine. They were from black market cannabis, which had been mixed with vitamin E acetate to cut it. So this is not a clear-cut thing, and it shouldn't be treated the same.
Thanks very much, Mike. Any questions for Mike? No? Thanks very much again, Mike. And I now call on a councillor to move a motion. Councillor Oak, and a councillor to second that motion. Councillor Pinder, Councillor Oak.
Oh, dear. As you heard before, I am particularly proposing to support this recommendation from management, in particular around the Greening Melbourne amendments. But on balance and hearing the arguments and from our officers and also from the submitters, I am open to the fact that this is going out and seeking feedback from the community on this proposal. So with respect to the vaping, I'm not going to say much more other than that I, like Councillor Riley, I think she said, was on the fence. And I felt, you know, through this process of 28 days of submissions, we'll hear more feedback. But I am certainly okay with the idea that it's about the impact on amenity, but I'm not commenting on health or the evidence that has been received about whether it is or isn't good or bad with respect to passive smoking. But I am not opposed to the idea of considering it on the grounds of amenity, given this is about the smoke-free areas of the city that we've put in place, and a lot of that was about the ability of everyone to enjoy outdoor dining. And if vaping is allowed, then this is a consideration not about the health but of the enjoyment in the area. But anyway, now I've said more than I wanted to, because I'm just happy to see and hear and receive the feedback from the 28-day process that this recommendation is kicking off. With respect to urban greening, as you all know, I'm very interested in this aspect, and this is about neatening up policies of the City of Melbourne and making things as more consistent, but acknowledging that some of the inconsistency is because we do have access, disability access, and other other reasons in our other local laws why urban greening may not be advisable in some sections of our streets and our community. So I understand why there has been a conflict in our local laws, but it was a real interest to me, particularly when I think it was in late 2017, early 2018, there were a flood of emails, from across the municipality of residents in North Melbourne and Carlton and Kensington, whereby we were on one hand saying, encouraging people to have greening, and on the other hand coming around and removing the pots that they'd put in our streets, or removing overhanging greening in the laneways. So there was a conflict in what we were saying on one hand and what we're doing on another hand, and it's not for anyone's fault, but this is as a result of we commissioned a report and a whole series of recommendations came through. Some of those recommendations obviously are going into our greening the city plan that we have, our GoCap, and our and also the recommendation tonight to just add a definition of green infrastructure within these local laws and within permit conditions. So again, I wholeheartedly support the recommendation for it to go out to consultation and hope that we can get on with allowing the community to have their pots in their streets and in their community gardens without it being against a local law.
Thanks, Councillor Oak. Councillor Pinder?
I just need to say that I'm a strong advocate for those who need to smoke or vape, and I've always said so, particularly in high-stress environments like outside hospitals and courts. So I really do believe that there are times when people do need to smoke, and we ought not to put laws over them or against them. However, tonight's report is really about the bylaw affecting this act of vaping in our smoke-free areas, those areas that have already been designated as smoke-free, and also bringing this bylaw, this into line with the State Tobacco Act of 1987, which also imposes restrictions on vaping as it does tobacco in certain areas. So I fully support this and look forward to all of the feedback in coming weeks.
Thanks, Councillor Pinder. Councillor Lee Lu.
Thank you, Chair. I also echo Councillor Pinder's point as well. Look, I think for me, someone who've worked or owned a tobacco shop, you know, been in the tobacco industry for probably 10 plus years, you know, and I've, but not, well, I was a smoker myself, but I quit. But, you know, in terms of vaping, it's a kind of a new area which I'm still trying to understand. But I think, as I've said, you know, I've always supported a lot with, you know, if there are parts where it is harmful or dangerous to the people, and if there are ways which we, government, can be able to support that, then we should always look at that. But also at the same time, we have to give smokers or people who do want to quit an option to have that, because I think taking everything away is quite difficult. But again, as Councillor Pinder has said, this is more about the local bylaw, and I think it's also the fact that, you know, it's I don't, you know, there are other great things in this whole package that I also support. As Councillor Oreck said, you know, there are some really great things in there, and so don't want to just look at just from one perspective, but rather from a whole holistic perspective. But I'll be quite interested to hear all the submissions and getting it out there and having that vigorous debate, and hopefully we can get some clarity and a bit more, because I can, you know, looking at all the different research and evidence behind around that, it's taken all the weekend. It's just, you know, I can't even make up my mind about this. So hopefully that will have some clarity, some clear air when this goes about. Yeah.
Thanks, Councillor Lee Lu. Any other speakers to this item? Councillor Leppert.
Thank you, Chair. 95% of the amendment text in this proposal is about green infrastructure, and I support every word. This is important, and I really hope that it's going to be well received. I particularly like the size of the penalty proposed. It is very small, and I think that the new regime for how we work with the community, especially where we don't want to just come down with the heavy hand of the law where things have not necessarily been done with awareness of what the local laws are, is really, really important. With anything with local laws, enforcement is important. I don't actually support the proposal for the vaping aspect of the local law on the face of it. The amendment's very simple. It just changes the definition, as Councillor Pinder has said, and that means that where there are smoke-free areas, these are also vape-free areas. Most of the submissions that we received assumed that we're banning vaping in the CBD. That's just not the case. The council probably doesn't have the power to ban vaping full stop, but we can certainly declare smoke vape-free areas if the proposal goes all the way through. We've only got two smoke-free areas outside the CBD. That's the Tan and the Princess Park running tracks. I don't think vaping's a huge problem there already. We've only got 10 smoke-free areas inside the CBD, a handful of busy laneways and malls. But I think the thing that's missing in this debate is that the majority of smoke-free areas in the City of Melbourne, and inside the CBD in particular, are areas that are regulated by the Tobacco Act, not the local law. So that's outdoor dining areas, it's playgrounds, it's hospital entrances, it's tram stops. You're already banned to vape by the state, not by council. So the reasons for given for pursuing this local law amendment are twofold, and they're on the front cover. One is to align with the Tobacco Act, and the other one is that Quit Victoria says that e-cigarettes aren't found to be an effective cessation tool. It goes on. And that's the reason I don't agree with, because the literature is full of dispute, and I've really pored over the Quit Victoria submission that came through over the last couple of days, and I thank them for it.
The thing that was missing in the report is that there is a utility of vaping to aid smokers who are unable to quit to move to a less harmful practice. And I completely accept that there's a lot of heartfelt submissions on that issue, and I tend to agree with them, but readily admit that I'm not a health expert. But the first reason is really important. Alignment with the Tobacco Act 1987 and the issue I raised at the beginning, enforcement. What's our reason for persisting with a regulatory regime that is different to the state? We're asking our constituents to remember two sets of laws when a no smoking equals no vaping thing is a much easier thing to remember, right? We are asking our constituents to remember that you can smoke in a you can vape in a no smoking area, but only in a very small handful of areas across the CBD and the two running tracks. And I just don't think that constituents' way of working within the law and remembering which laws are which actually works that way. There's a lot of merit in harmonisation between the state and the local laws in terms of what the rules are, because when you get it wrong, even though we try not to fine people, we try and educate people, particularly if English isn't your first language, particularly if you're not the person who tends to nerd out like me and read local laws in their spare time, I do that sometimes, then there's a very strong argument to say that, no, you do need a one rule for everyone because that is the memorable thing. So I actually think that the strongest argument here, even if you disagree with all of the health reasons, is that we kind of just need to harmonise our rules with the state. And if the problem is that the rules with the state are wrong, well, the state rules are the ones that need to change. So I completely leave open the door to changing my mind at the other end of this debate and say, no, actually, this is a big enough deal for the local council to go on its own and say, no, you can continue to vape in smoke-free areas. But by voting against this now, we wouldn't be allowing that public debate. So I want to see what comes back through those public submissions, and I'll support this today. But I just make the point that we're not banning vaping. This is about the definition of smoke-free areas, and I look forward to the debate.
Thanks, Councillor Leppett. I will follow you because I wholeheartedly agree with you. Interestingly enough, I sort of, you know, question my stance on vaping, and again, I don't think I've got enough of the detail and enough of the information to really form any hard stance on vaping. I'm not a smoker. I haven't been a smoker, but Mike's submission is just one of many on people who are trying to quit or move to a less harmful substance. What I am convinced on is the ease of enforcement, and where you have a complexity of rules, what you can be guaranteed of is the difficulty of enforcement is writ large. The difficulty of adhering to those laws is also writ large for people wanting to do the right thing. So I am convinced on that front. So I'm in a position where initially I wanted to split these two because I'm in wholehearted support of the greening bylaw changes, and I think Councillor Oak will finally get there after I think about 4 years of pushing for this. So this is a really good thing, and so it was going to be easy for me to say yes, I wholeheartedly support the changes to the green infrastructure, the greening bylaws. I'm not convinced on the vaping bylaw changes. I absolutely take the amenity impacts, but what I am convinced on is that joining up state and local laws is a good thing. And then the other thing that I agree with Councillor Leppin on, that's been highlighted by a number of our speakers, is that what we're talking about is those areas which are already designated smoke-free. So, again, the ability for someone to move to something which is much less harmful or to actually move on that continuum of potentially quitting altogether isn't removed because they can simply walk to a non-smoke-free area and then continue that battle, which I know many people unfortunately have to fight. So I'm looking forward to receiving lots of information in these submissions, hopefully lots of information on health impacts, on the ability to assist in things like quitting in this process. And that's what the consultation on a bylaw is all about, that we hear from all of those submissions. So with that, I'm comfortable in putting this out for comment. Any other speakers to this item? Councillor Watts or Councillor Riley? No? Councillor Oak, did you want to close? If not, I'll put that to the vote. All those in favour, and I declare that carried unanimously, and I hand back to the Lord Mayor to close the meeting, or to continue the meeting.
Thank you. This concludes reports from management to be considered in open session. There are no items of general business to be considered in open session this evening. Councillors, are there any items of urgent business to be considered this evening? Thank you. Well, that leads me to say that the three public questions that we received were dealt with earlier, none for the closing part. It'd be interesting if somebody put one in for the closing part only. This is the end of a virtual meeting. Thank you so much to everybody who's been involved, from our councillors who are participating remotely, our submitters, people that ask questions, people that are listening, councillors, the exec team, our tech team. Well done, it all worked, and we are thrilled. And so we are able to declare this very interesting meeting closed at 7:15. Thank you.